Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first in a three-part series that will be hopefully not only exploring, but also clarifying what is one of the more complex areas of practical halacha. Broadly speaking, when it comes to the kashrut of our kitchens, there's a lot of, for better and worse, if we're being honest, there's a lot of received practice of what we do. And in particular, when it comes to ovens, there's a lot of different opinions over what exactly is appropriate, how exactly we should conduct ourselves, what exactly we should be doing. And so over the next 3 weeks, we will be diving in depth into really getting to grips with not just the topic of, you know, meat and dairy in the oven, because truth be told, I could summarize practically what to do in about 10 minutes, but instead to actually understand the sources behind it, understand the conceptual underpinnings, understand exactly what it is that's going on. Because I think a lot of us, when it comes to the laws of kashrut, there's an intuitive understanding of how it works, but there is very little actual knowledge of how it works. And I think I've told this story before. It's an amazing story that the son of Rav Soloveitchik tells of one day when his mother was ill. And so Rav Soloveitchik and his son, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, back then probably not Rabbi Dr. Chaim, just little Chaim, but Rav Soloveitchik and Chaim Soloveitchik were tasked with, you know, taking care of the house. And at one point they're cleaning the dishes in the kitchen, and the Rav Soloveitchik's wife walks in and she freaks out. Like, what are you, that's the fleshik dish towel. You're using it to clean the dairy dish. You're trafing up the kitchen. To which Rav Soloveitchik responds a little bit puzzled, like, what are you talking about? The Shulchan Aruch says explicitly, and she cuts him off, you and your Shulchan Aruch are trafing up my kitchen. And that is, it illustrates, I think, a way a lot of people relate to Hilchot Kashrut. We have this intuitive understanding that this is how things are, with no awareness for what halacha actually demands. And sometimes what will happen, people don't do this intentionally, but when people actually come across what the actual halacha is, they're like, no, that can't be. That's just wrong. And people will almost sometimes question the legitimacy of what people are doing, when in fact what they are doing is in complete consonance with halacha. And so though we understand to a certain degree intuitively, a lot of people, be it they are raised that way, when they become observant, they are kind of taught the foundational principles that on which kashrut is built. To really appreciate and understand this question, we first have to understand just kashrut 101. And so for the vast majority of this evening, we are barely going to talk about ovens. Because before we talk about ovens, we have to first understand exactly what the mechanics are and what exactly, halachically speaking, is going on in the more general realm of kashrut as it applies to and impacts our daily lives in our kitchens. Generally speaking, and I've talked about this in other contexts before, the way we live our Jewish lives is to take advantage of the fact that in the 21st century, even people with not too many means are wealthy when considered against most of human history. And so what we do is we buy multiples of lots of things. It's not particularly expensive these days. You go to Walmart and you buy as many pots as you could possibly need in order to cater to all of your situations. You don't just have a meat pot and a dairy pot. You have a power of pot. You have your various, I'm not going to try and start constructing the permutations in my head, but you have your various, each and every pot has, like, you have multiple versions of it for all the various permutations you could possibly consider. And the truth is, while that's a really, really simple way of solving things, we can't live in a Jewish world where the answer to every halachic quandary is spend money. And it can't be that halacha assumes were all wealthy enough, and especially again, when we think of this question regarding ovens, that we're all wealthy enough and we have the kitchen space to go out and buy two ovens. That can't be the answer. And as we will see in the sources a little bit at the end of today, and then also next week and the week after, it's blatantly clear that the scenarios Chazal were living with and many rabbis in medieval times, we can't even imagine these kinds of kashrut scenarios in our own lives. We've made our lives so simple through spending money, but the solution can't just be to spend money. And I actually want to share the source sheet at this point, because there's a really important source that really bears relevance to this. And it is from the Gemara in Pesachim. So it's talking not about the kashrut of meat and milk, but obviously the preparing one's home to make sure it's kashrut LePesach. And the Gemara records a question between Ravina and Rav Ashi. Amale Ravina LeRav Ashi, Hani Sakini Befischa. When it comes to our knives on Pesach, heichi avdinan lehu, how do we kasher them? Amar le, so Rav Ashi responded, ledidi chaltaka avdinan, I just craft new ones, I get new knives. Amar le, Ravina responded, tinach mar de efshar le, oh, that's all great for you. You're able to do so. Source number two, Rashi, you know, makes this really explicit. Shehari Asher Atai, you're wealthy. You're rich. You can afford to go out and buy new knives, make new knives. Delon F. Charley Mai, what about the rest of us? Those of us who don't have the money, Halach has to be able to respond to people who the solution can't just be go out and buy a new one. If the only way to prepare your home for Pesach is to build a Pesach kitchen, something's gone wrong, or go on an expensive Pesach program. That can't be the answer. Similarly, there is a concept that we find in a lot of different halachic literature. It's a fascinating topic. I don't want to explore it in any detail, but we have to be very careful about what's called being motzi la'az al rishonim, of unintentionally, essentially claiming that the great rabbis of the past didn't keep kosher. Because again, the cases we will see soon, it is very clear. Like Rashi, this will come as a shock to many of you. Rashi didn't have two ovens in his kitchen. He probably didn't have an oven in his kitchen, because that's not how ovens used to work. Definitely, as we will see a little bit later today, in the times of Chazal, I mean, they didn't have kitchens in which to have ovens, let alone, you know, having two of them. And so we have to be very careful again when we talk about these various halachic considerations, that we aren't claiming unintentionally that the great rabbis of the past basically ate treif all their lives. So we have two reasons to already think a little bit more about our approach to kitchen kashrut. But I want to begin with kitchen kashrut 101. To a certain degree, the way I like to think about it is the question we are always asking when something has gone wrong in our kitchen, between meat and dairy, you know, the classic example. The essential question we're asking is, has it become contaminated? It's not a word we really use Jewishly, but it's a word that conveys everything that we are really asking. You thought you were taking out the almond milk from the fridge to pour into the meat dish, and you accidentally picked the actual milk. And now you've just poured a small amount of it into the meat dish, and you're calling me in a panic. What you're essentially asking me is, has the milk contaminated the meat dish to the point that we now have a problem? Similarly, you stick the dairy spoon in the meat dish. And again, the question is, again, has contamination taking place? Both sides this time. Has something gone wrong to the point that what has happened before us has become contaminated? And there's two primary things that we're worried about. One is more likely in the kosher kitchen, which is meat and dairy. That can be a source of contaminating one another. Alternatively, it could be you know, non-kosher. I am going to use colloquially a lot the word treif because I can't help it, but the technically correct within me has to already note that treif actually refers to a very specific form of non-kosher meat, but I'm just going to use it colloquially. So again, sometimes it can happen. You accidentally, you go to the store, you pick up the wrong product. You thought it had a hechsher, you know, 2 years ago it had a hechsher and you've never really checked it since. And now you've been using it and oh my goodness, it turns out it's treif. Again, fundamentally, the question is that the arch question at the heart of the entirety of kitchen kashrut is it contaminated? And to a certain extent, what you can do, the laws of kashrut are incredibly complicated, but they lend themselves nicely to actually a flowchart almost of all the various different situations that can help resolve this question. A lot of them aren't our concern, but it's important for us to understand the most fundamental principles at the heart of Hilchot Kashrut. Question number one. How does something become contaminated? How does the milk, you know, infect, let's keep with these words, infect the meat or vice versa? How does contamination take place? And second, and more importantly, how do we test for contamination? When you accidentally poured the real milk into the meat, how do we know? How do we resolve the situation? So there's a lot that could be said about this topic. And for our purposes, we're going to concern ourselves with the primary form of contamination, and that is heat. It is not always true. There are some significant situations where heat is not necessary. The most obvious example is pouring cold milk into cold chicken soup, and you still have for yourself a problem. But generally speaking, we assume that the primary way in which something will become contaminated is heat. How does it work? Imagine the following situation. You take for yourself a frying pan. You put some chicken, you're heating it and you're cooking chicken in the frying pan. The principle at the heart of halacha is that the pan is boleya, is the term. It absorbs through the heat, it absorbs some of the chicken. I don't want to get into the question of it. And for people who were the shir now, what seems like an age ago, when we talked about Hilchot Pesach, much of this will be familiar because in a shocking turn of events, kashering your kitchen for Pesach and kashering your kitchen in general has a tremendous amount of overlap. But I don't want to get into the question of when we say a pot absorbed something, whether we're talking about something physical or metaphysical. I don't want to get into that question right now. Regardless, halachically, it is true that the pot absorbs some of the chicken. It is boleya. Great. You cook your chicken, you go off, you eat it. Wonderful. Fast forward another 8 hours. And now you want to cook some potatoes. And so you take the same pot again. It's clean, but you take the same pot, but it's been, you know, 8 hours. And you cook your potatoes on that same pot. That same pot that was boleya the chicken is now polated. And so we assume that the potatoes in the pot now absorb some of the chicken that had been previously cooked in the pot. The problem is that those potatoes you were cooking, you were hoping to sprinkle some cheese over. And so that's when you call me. And what you're essentially asking is, have the potatoes been contaminated with meat to the point that I can't put cheese on them anymore because they've almost become meaty themselves? The principle is that you need heat and contact in order to effect taste transfer. This is two crucial components. Again, there may be some other examples where it's not necessary, but broadly speaking, and particularly relevant to us, you need heat and you need contact between the two. It could be, again, the spoon and the meat, or it could be the chicken and the meat, or the meat and the pan, whatever, but there has to be contact in order to affect the taste transfer. As we turn now to the source sheet, and I want to review the three most fundamental sources that kind of sketch out the core components of Hilchot Kashrut. The first of which are two Mishnayot in Chulin, which teach us the following, So the Mishnah in Chulin is talking about the sciatic nerve, the Gid HaNosher, which famously is prohibited. It is forbidden. We're not allowed to eat it. And the Mishnah states in source number 3, Yorech Shenet Bashel Ba Gid HaNosher. So you have this scenario, and the thigh has been cooked, and its sciatic nerve has not been removed. Im Yesh Ba Benotein Ta'am. If there is enough sciatic nerve, I'll explain this more in a little bit. If there's enough sciatic nerve in order to impart its taste, to make the thigh taste sciatic nervy, Hareza Asura, it's forbidden, it's prohibited, it's treif. Ketzad Misha'arin Ota, how do we evaluate this? If there's enough of it, what does that mean? Kvasara Belafet. We treat it like meat imparting flavor to a turnip. This is a surprisingly, what on earth is this answer? So essentially it's a thought experiment. Imagine the sciatic nerve is a piece of meat and the thigh is a turnip. And essentially it's a thought experiment. How much meat would you need in the pot to make the turnip taste meaty? And it's a, you know, if the volumes, look at how much sciatic, look at the ratio of sciatic nerve to thigh, and if it matches the ratio of meat to turnip, there you go, it's a problem. We then get a few more crucial principles of kashrut in Mishnah 5. Gid hanosheh shenit boshel im hagidim. So now we get a slightly different scenario. The sciatic nerve has been cooked with other nerves. Now, that's, you know, it's apples, all with apples. They all look the same. Bizman shemakiro. If you can identify which one is the sciatic nerve, so first thing you do is you take that out. Benotein tam. And then you evaluate and you have to ask and figure out, does the pot of nerves taste like sciatic nerve? The imlav, and if you can't distinguish, if you can't tell which one is the sciatic nerve, kulan asurin, we consider the whole thing to be prohibited, lest you eat the sciatic nerve. I've never said sciatic nerves so many times in a series of sentences, and boy, is that one of those words that starts to lose its meaning very, very quickly. The harotev, when it comes to the broth that they've been cooked in, benotein ta'am, if it tastes of gid hanasha, you have a problem. V'chein chaticha shel nevela, the same is true with non-kosher meat. V'chein chaticha shel dag tamei, non-kosher fish, shenit bashlu im hachatichot, that is cooked along with other kosher versions of the same kind. So you're cooking a bunch of stew meat, and accidentally within that stew meat is treif stew meat. Bizman shemakiran benotein tam, if you can detect which one's a non-kosher meat, you take it out. Benotein tam, and you taste, and then you evaluate whether or not it tastes of the non-kosher meat. Ve'imlav kulan asurot, if not, it's all prohibited. Vaharotev benotein tam, and the principle of the broth is also we evaluate it based on taste. The most important thing to extract from these mishnayot is this principle of netinat tam, taste transfer. The overarching way of evaluating whether or not something has become contaminated is through tasting it. You assume that the food, the principle is that the food has absorbed the taste. So if we go back to our potatoes and chicken example from before, if the potatoes taste chickeny, you know that this is what the Mishnah is saying. If the potatoes taste chickeny, you know they have become contaminated with potato. If the chicken soup tastes milky, you know it's treif. Now, you may all be wondering, if you worry that you dropped some milk into your chicken soup, if the evaluation to determine whether it's been contaminated or not is netinat ta'am, well, we have a problem. Because if you go to taste that chicken soup, one of two things is either going to happen. Number one, it's going to taste like chicken. Phew, relief, great. Number two, is going to taste like milk. And you just ate treif. And you have a huge problem. So when the Mishnah speaks about netinat ta'am, evaluating things based on taste, it does not seem to really make a lot of sense. And this is exactly what the Gemara addresses in source number 4. Ravin bar Rav Ada amar, kilchit be'il pas have. So Ravin bar Rav Ada described a case in which we have kilchit, which is a non-kosher fish, and it falls into a stew pot. Va'atu shailuhu l'Rebbe Yochanan. And they went to ask Rabbi Yochanan about its status. Va'amarle, and he responded to them, L'ta'ame kafela arma'a. Give it to a non-Jewish cook and have them taste it. Ah, that's actually a pretty simple solution. If you worry, oh, my chicken soup might have milk dropped into it. So what do? You find a local non-Jewish chef, let's assume that's plausible, you're lucky you live next door to one, and you take a little cup of your thing, and you knock on their door and you ask them to come into your kitchen and you give them a spoon of it, and you're like, what does it taste like? And if they're like, well, strange, because it tastes like milk, even though it's chicken soup, you have a problem. If they turn around and say, tastes like chicken soup, great, you're good. And this leads the Gemara to make a few more fundamental statements. The second paragraph of source number 4, Da Amar Rava. Amor Rabbanan, the rabbi stated, Beta'ama. Rava says the following. Amor Rabbanan Beta'ama, Va'amor Rabbanan Bekfela, Va'amor Rabbanan Beshishin. The sages declared that there are times when a Jew tastes the food to determine if it's become contaminated. And there are times when the sages declared that you pass it on to a non-Jewish cook. And then there are times where you evaluate based on shishim on 60. Min b'she'eino mino. If the food is mixed with food not of its type. So imagine you have an apple that's dropped into a pot of, a piece of meat has dropped into a pot of apples. It's a random example. Dehetera b'tama, if it's permitted for a Jew to still eat, then you get a Jew to taste it. The classic example of this is teruma. There are some foods that are only permitted to Kohanim, or at least in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, there was foods that only the Kohanim could eat because they would not... Not specific food items, but foods would be truma, would be set aside for Kohanim. And so you accidentally dropped some truma stew meat into your pot of apples. So you call one of the many, many Kohanim at BIAV around to bite into an apple and you ask them, does it taste like meat? That's how you get a Jew to taste it. De Isura. If we're talking about non-kosher meat that's dropped into your pot of apples, b'kfela, you pass that on to the non-Jewish cook. Umin b'mino. And when we're dealing with food mixed with foods of its own type, apples and apples. Deleika l'mekim ata'ame, where you have no possibility of discerning the taste. Inami min b'she'eno mino de isura. Or, it was with food not of its type, but we're worried about it being treif, deleika kfela, and there is no chef, beshishim, you evaluate based on 60. What's interesting is we all kind of are taught this rule of 60, that basically you determine whether the non-kosher is less than 60 times, or you determine that the kosher, if it's 60 times the volume of the non-kosher, you're good, is actually kind of the least greatest choice in the times of the Gemara. However, fast forward to the Shulchan Aruch, who declares the following. Isur shenit arev beheter min b'she'eino mino. A prohibited food that was mixed in with kosher food not of the same type. Kegon chelev shenit arev bebasa, fat mixed with meat. Typo in source number 5's translation, but there you go. We know what it means. Yita'amu oved kochavim. You ask a non-Jew to taste it. We're now no longer asking for a professional, we're just asking any generic non-Jew. Im omer she'ein bo ta'am chelev, if they don't taste the fat, omer she'yesh bo ta'am elashub hagum, or they say they taste it, but it's now it is disgusting, mutar, the whole thing is permitted. V'hu she'lo yehe sof olashbech, as long as it's not going to improve the taste. V'tzarich she'lo yada she'sumchem alav, and as long as the non-Jewish person doesn't know they're being relied on. Vim ein sham oved kol chavim latama, if there's no non-Jewish person to taste it, misharin b'shishim, we evaluate based on 60, v'chem inhu min b'mina, or if it's foods of the same type, deleka lameka matama, where you can't discern the taste, misharim b'shishim, to which the Rama adds, v'ein nohagim achshav lismoch ha'oved kol chavim, we don't rely on non-Jews anymore to taste food, u'misharin hakol b'shishim. We always rely on the principle of shishim of 1/60. That is Kashrut 101. Kitchen Kashrut 101 is, we are always asking, when we worry about non-kosher food getting mixed in with the kosher foods in our kitchen, or dairy and meat getting mixed up, we are always asking, is it contaminated? Which is really a proxy for, does it taste like the thing it's not supposed to taste like? And we evaluate it nowadays based on the rule of shishim. There are a lot of other different factors that may be involved, but fundamentally, you drop your dairy spoon into your meat chicken soup. That's essentially what you're evaluating. Everything I've said until now has zero relevance to ovens. Very important to learn, very important to see the fundamental sources that teach us the crucial rules of kashrut and the crucial principle of netinat ta'am, of imparting taste, from which everything is derived. But if not zero, then a negligible relevance to anything to do with our ovens. And that's for a very simple reason. I said it earlier. In order for netinat ta'am to take place, generally speaking, we require two things. We require heat and we require contact. Every notion of kashrut we have seen, and really the entire idea behind netinat ta'am, rests on the idea that the non-kosher, or the dairy against the meat, is touching in order to effect taste transfer. Think about it. The spoon goes into the chicken soup. It's making contact. All of these cases assume contact. The kilchit fell into the stew pot. Non-kosher food is mixed in with food. In other words, it's all touching. Maybe some of you cook in your ovens in the most bizarre ways, but at least the way we cook it, and I assume this is true, if you want to cook a brisket, you cook a brisket in a tray. And you put the tray, I don't imagine there are many people who put the brisket directly onto the racks of the oven, and then right next to the brisket, just tip a giant thing of mac and cheese. But that would be, and then that wouldn't actually be an oven shaila anymore. That would just be a generic general kashrut shaila. If you think about the way we cook in our ovens, let's imagine the most extreme case possible, where we're going to get the closest to the scenarios thus far being described. You take a brisket in one tray, uncovered, mac and cheese in another tray, uncovered, and you put them next to one another in the same oven and cook it. They're still not making contact. There does not seem to be, according to the kind of basic principles of kashrut, anything to indicate that the two foods can contaminate one another. That's just, they have to be touching. The way you'd have to tip the mac and cheese on top of the brisket, and then you have a problem, but you're not worrying about the oven. the entire way we use our ovens nowadays has no notion of physical contact. In fact, even the oven itself is making no physical contact with the food. The oven is just a giant hot box. The contact the oven is making is with the pan, is with the tray, is with the pot. Nothing is ever making contact. So as important as the basics of kashrut are, there does not seem to be any way for netinat ta'am to actually be. Now, obviously, this year is 3 weeks long, so we're about to see some sources that indicate maybe there is. But I think it's really, really important to nonetheless stress, because the way we intuitively, think of kashrut is the mere presence of meat and milk in the same vicinity is going to cause problems. But that's clearly not what we're worried about here. So what is the potential issue? So as we will see over the coming weeks, there are two potential issues. We'll talk about the first one. I'll introduce it tonight. And it comes from a case in the Gemara that describes a situation, going back to what I said at the beginning about always being careful and that we're not being motzi laz ala rishonim, that we're not in any way criticizing the rabbis of the past. We are about to see a case in the Gemara that the idea of it actually happening will make the hairs on the back of your neck stand. But the Gemara in Pesachim records the following. Amar Rav, Besar Shechuta Shomen, Fatty Kosher Meat, Shetzal'o im Basar Nevela Kachush, roasted in an oven together with lean non-kosher meat. Asor. That is prohibited. You are not allowed to cook kosher meat together with non-kosher, even if the meatier one is kosher. You cannot put, says Rav, kosher meat and non-kosher meat in the same oven together. Why? Mipat me mehadari, because they flavor one another. The Levi Amar, but Levi comes along and says, Afilu basar shchuta kachush, v'tzalo im basar nevela shamein, mutar. Even if the non-kosher meat is the fatty, juicy one, and the kosher meat is the lean one, it is perfectly appropriate to cook those two things in the same oven. Important sidebar here. In the ancient world, you didn't have private ovens. There was a communal oven or someone would own an oven and everyone kind of used it together. It also looked more like what we would think of nowadays as a pizza oven. But still, the point here is the food is never making contact. But the image is cooking at the same time as one another, a brisket and a pork roast. Rav says, you can't do that in the same oven. Levi says, yeah, you can. No problems there. No issue whatsoever. If we think of back to our uncovered brisket and our uncovered mac and cheese, Rav says what we're all thinking, it's a problem. Levi says what no one's thinking, which is, well, that's perfectly acceptable and fine and no issue whatsoever. My timer asks the Gemara, what's the reason? Why is Levi so confident there's no issue? And here comes the crucial phrase. Recha ba'olmahu. Our only concern is aroma. V'recha lav miltahi. And aroma is insignificant. Again, in the same oven, our brisket and our mac and cheese are not making contact with one another. There is no way for the two of them to transfer the taste. Rav comes along and says, yes, there is. The aroma, The aroma of the brisket will waft over into the mac and cheese and contaminate the mac and cheese. The waft of the mac and cheese will contaminate the brisket. Rav says, Recha miltahi, that's a problem. The aroma is substantial. It's significant. Even if you don't have physical contact between these two things, the mere fact that they are in the presence of one another, cooking at the same time, and thus generating an aroma, that makes it treif. Levi says, nope. Recha lav miltahi. The aroma is nothing. If they're not making contact, you don't have a problem. This source is essentially repeated again in another Gemara for slightly different reasons, but this is basically the sole Talmudic source on ovens. And once again, I want to stress this. Let's dwell on the case again. What the source is saying is a debate whether or not you can cook kosher and treif, or by extension, meat and milk, at the same time in the same oven next to one another, as long as they're not touching. All our questions, and by the way, please wait until the final week before you go and act on anything you learn. I would strongly discourage you from cooking a brisket and mac and cheese uncovered next to one another in the oven. Please wait until we've finished the series before acting on anything. But the sole scenario the Gemara is talking about is them in the same oven at the same time. None of like our thing of like, well, I cooked meat in it 8 hours ago. Can I now cook my mac and cheese in my oven? No, next to one another. And one opinion of the Gemara says it's completely fine, it's completely permitted to cook them in the oven at the exact same time, because the only reason it is clear, it is obvious, it is explicit, the only reason we would have for worrying about the two contaminating one another is their aroma. They're not making physical contact. The only issue is the waft, the aroma in contaminating each other. The Gemara actually tells us a very important additional point, which is Aved Levi, Ovada Bei Reish Geluta, Bigdi V'Davar Acher. That Levi lived his life in accordance with this principle. Levi wasn't just like, you know, trying to be controversial. He wasn't just, you know, there's nothing, you know, like sometimes, you know, I'm definitely, you know, guilty of this. A lot of people are, where like, you know, you hear a scenario, you're just like, it's not a problem. And then when you actually have to, you know, put your money where your mouth is, you're like, well, maybe I wouldn't do it. Maybe I'd be slightly more stringent. Levi did this in the house of the Reish Geluta, the Exilarch. There was a kid that had been cooked in the same oven at the same time as something else. Rashi adds a chazir, a pig. And Levi was like, oh, it's kosher. What's the problem? And took his fork out and just started chomping away at the kid. No problem whatsoever. So there is a fundamental question when it comes to halachic decision making, which is the Gemara itself doesn't explicitly conclude which view is right. Is the halacha in accordance with Rav? Or is the halacha in accordance with Levi, as we can imagine? This is a very, very important question to answer. One we will spend a significant amount of next week delving into in some detail. But it's worth noting that already it seems to be that among the major Rishonim, among the major medieval authorities, they are far more inclined towards the position of Levi than the position of Rav. That when you have brisket and pork in the same oven uncovered, not touching, but nonetheless in the same oven, being cooked next to one another, there seems to be a strong indication that we're not worried. The brisket is still kosher. Rashi, commenting on our Gemara, says, Va'afal gav dekaima tanai keveta de Rav. Even though Rav is able to support Tanaitic support to justify his statement, Hilchata keveta de Levi. The halacha follows Levi. Rashi says it clearly. Recha lav milta, he were not worried about the aroma. It's not halachically significant. Rambam, and this is also the opinion of Riff, has a slightly more nuanced take. He writes in source number 8, Ein solin basar shchuta im basar nevela or behema tmei betanor echad. You can't cook, you can't roast kosher and treif in the same oven, va'afal pi she'ein nogin zebaza, even when they don't touch one or another. Ve'imtzal an hari zemutar. But if you do, it's still kosher. What Rambam is giving here is two of the most important words, one of the most important distinctions in the world of kashrut, in a lot of areas of halacha, but particularly in kashrut, lechatchila and bedi'evet. There are some things that halachically speaking, you are not allowed to intentionally do. It is forbidden to intentionally do X, but you know what? If accidentally, unintentionally, mistakenly you did it, it's still fine. So what Rambam's saying here is exactly that. You should not take a roast and a mac and cheese uncovered in the same oven and cook them. But what happens if, in a moment of madness, you do it? Says Rambam, it's fine. Va'afilu chayta ha'asura shmeina harbeh v'hamuteret razan, even when, again, the kosher, the non-kosher meat is the fatty one, it's going to have far more flavor to impart, and the kosher meat is the lean one, it's still fine. Shehareach eino oseh, for aroma cannot make something forbidden. Ve'eino oseh ela ta'amo shel isor, only the flavor can make something prohibited. Only prohibited flavor makes things prohibited. They have to make contact, they have to touch. Aroma isn't enough. Again, Rambam doesn't think it's a good idea. He doesn't want you doing it, but he turns around when you call me in a panic. Don't ask me how. Please don't. I don't want to explain it, but I just cooked a roast and a mac and cheese at the same time in the oven, both of them uncovered. If Rambam's answering that phone is just like, wait, what's the problem? It's fine. It's fine. We could summarize Rambam with just, it's fine. That's basically what he's writing here in source number 8. Again, follows the opinion of Levi. The dissenter is Tosafot. But even as we'll see right now, there are a few caveats to his dissenting. Mikan posig Rabbeinu Tam, Karav. It is from here that Rabbeinu Tam, one of the great medieval authorities, followed the opinion of Rav. And then the Baalei Tosfot continue. Uva tanorim gedolim shelanu. In our large ovens, however, nireh, it seems, dumutar la'afot lechem im oto pashtida. It is permitted to bake bread along with pashtida, which is a dish. Ha'el u'mechusot heitev, since they are both covered. Have a ke'en shtei k'dei rot, and therefore it's as though they are two pots in the same oven. Va'afilu paldunash sheish la reich chazak, and even this other dish paldunash, which has an incredibly potent smell, ein nir el rebi shehi asor. Even Rabbeinu Tam doesn't think that's prohibited. Sheish avir merube b'tanor, because the oven has a lot of space. Va'ha'evel mit poshet, which allows the steam to dissipate. We will analyze in far more detail Rabbeinu Tam next week. But what we see very, very clearly from the sources in the Gemara and Rishonim, that at first glance, there doesn't seem to be too much to cause us concern. Because remember, we are talking about in these sources cooking meat and milk in the same oven at the same time, all uncovered. They're not touching, but that's it. They're in their own pots, they're in their own pans, they're in their own trays. The scenario we are dealing with is not that. We are dealing with a scenario where we're doing them at different times in the same oven. At first glance, it seems like, and again, there's a reason why this is 3 weeks long. But at first glance, it seems like there's nothing to worry about. that there really isn't anything so far among the core sources. And the truth is that the more and more concerns we will raise, broadly speaking, the less core the sources will become. Doesn't necessarily change our practice. But the most important thing to extract from this evening, and what I want everyone, you know, if I summarize everything in just a few sentences, it's this, as I stop the screen share. The core component of Hilchot Kashrut, things get trafed up through contamination. Contamination occurs through, generally speaking, heat transfer, though not always, but contact. Meat and milk touch one another. Treif and kosher touch one another. And through that, they can absorb from each other. That can't happen in an oven. That's just not how we cook in our ovens. The meat and the dairy, even if they're cooked at the same time, uncovered, are never touching one another. They never make contact. And so it's impossible for the taste to transfer that way. And no one disputes this, by the way. That we will never dispute the fact that they aren't touching one another. That no one will ever consider that as the way by which they transfer the taste. The debate in the Gemara is whether the aroma, the smell, that intangible quality that emerges from the food as it's cooking, whether that contaminates, whether that transfers its taste into the other food. Rav says yes. Levi says no. The Rishonim seem to side with Levi, at least in principle, or side with Rav, but offer of 15,000 different heterim, which we will begin exploring next week. But the most important thing to extract, and this is where we have to start thinking halachically, as opposed to intuitively. A friend of mine is a rabbi in Manchester, and he was once telling me how whenever someone asks him if they can do something on Shabbos, he always turns around to them and is like, tell me why you can't. Because intuitively, we often think, oh, we can't. He it's like a learning exercise for the members of his shul. Like, yeah, intuitively, you think it's wrong, but actually tell me what the actual problem is. When it comes to meat and dairy in our ovens, what's the problem? Because it is not the problem in every other aspect of our kitchens. The milk goes in the meat it touches. The spoon goes in the dairy spoon goes in the meat it touches. That is never happening with the oven. Thus far, we have seen one candidate to cause a problem, and that is Reach, aroma. Next week, please God, we will begin also discussing the second candidate, but we'll leave it to next week to find out what that is. And then in the third week, putting all of this together, will please God allow us to look at a few different halachic solutions as to how we can cook meat and milk in our kitchens nowadays without violating any of these principles.